I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today, we've taken Penn Sound on the road to Bard College along the Hudson River north of New York City, where I'm joined here by a live audience and by Pierre Joris, poet, translator, fabulous blogger at Nomadics, born in France, raised in Luxembourg, commuter along the Brooklyn-Albany axis since the early 90s, author of more than 20 books of poetry, a truly great translator and advocate of the poetry of Paul Celan, and with Jerome Rothenberg, co-editor of Poems for the Millennium, and by Charles Bernstein, whose All the Whiskey in Heaven beautifully selects his poems from across the books and decades, graduate of Bronx Science High, author of a Harvard undergrad thesis on Wittgenstein and Stein. Did I say Stein? Stein. Big fan of popular music lyrics from the 1930s, founder of a poetry association for collaborations between Chinese and U.S. poets. And Charles is looking at me crosswise with this odd introduction, and co-founder and co-director with me, I'm proud to say, of Penn Sound. And by Joan Retallick, poet, critic, multidisciplinary scholar, poethicist, longtime director of the Great Language and Thinking Program here at Bard, where she is the John D. and Catherine D. MacArthur Professor. And she's looking at me to add something or correct.
I am no longer the director of the Language and Thinking Program.
I think I said long-time director. So
true.
Somewhat past long-time
not,
director.
Not as long as this. And last year, I stepped down.
Congratulations. But you did found the thing. You did found it, right?
No, I found it, but I didn't found it.
Okay. It found you for many years.
Me.
Author of many books of poetry, including Memoir, Errata Suite, Procedural Elegies, / Western Civ Continued. Do I say continued or And How to Do Things with Words. Hi, everybody. Charles, Pierre, so glad you could meet us here up here at Bard today. Hi.
It's a great pleasure. To be here.
Great to be here.
And Joan, thanks so much for hosting us.
My pleasure.
So we're here to talk about one section of a book by Jackson McCloe titled Words. The book is titled Words and Ends from Ez, as in end, as in and, published by Avenue B Press in 1989. Each of the 10 sections in the book consists of words and word fragments drawn from the cantos of Ezra Pound by a systematic chance operation based on the positioning in the original Pound text of the letters spelling the name Ezra Pound. The ninth section, which was composed in 1983, selects words from Pound's final installment of the cantos called Drafts and Fragments of Cantos, numbers 110 to 117. So our poem begins with words from Canto 110. Penn Sound's McCloe page includes a recording of him performing this poem for the Radio Reading Project in 1998. So here now is Jackson McCloe reading from Words and Ends from Ez.
So anyway, this is part 9, Words and Ends from Ez. Osier's curve he wall, thin hout exultant, seen impidity, exultance, as lore leaf, paler rock layers at. Un edegno ia had ever otsalio, e tracciolino icardo psit. Love bluer than ard uridices, isance, a's rest, use at p, n of truction errants, faced, e tz, e France, is lan, peer, forces, a nuisance, was Napoleon, all, 22nd, aryization, der ed talleyrand political. E orage id upter night al and e isntines prologo ulta. Perform per I juniper was and I landy Ozart overhanging beat pace to out irk and ord etzo here itzia ping Norance I put and his name on and uti ns verned uptake e old a question conduct inted en zephyrus ear itty are pale young four chrones ye mind ear a's ears state Paris nor fruit thing t said Esser Ozart friends to each peace world un husk finished to tides e rzo hird heaven paradiso e over xius il and paradiso e o Zagros e arch great paradiso soa noir a sun ling de et.
Before we get too far into this, let's why don't the four of us collaboratively describe the process? Who wants to start? How does it work? Charles?
It's a diastic, as you said, procedure. Diastic is McClough's word for text selection, dia reading through. So he's using a found or appropriated text and he's doing a procedure on it. The procedure is based on the EZRA POUND. It's a complex procedure that every time I go back to it, I have to.
Does he vary it at all, or is he being strict?
He's strict. And
Joan, I think he's varying here because this is very different, for instance, from the way he uses it in the Virginia Woolf poems, where he finds letter by letter in the words in the text his string that is guiding him to the words in the text, each in its place in the word. So actually here the first word that he finds would have to have an E in the first place. The second word would have to have a Z in the second place, and so on.
But actually, what he starts with a Z here because the last poem, the eighth poem, did the E.
Had the
E.
He
picked up the Z in the word Crozier.
Right.
So he took the Z in Crozier, and because Z is the second letter in Ezra, he goes back one letter so that Z is in the second place. So that's how we get Ozier.
That's right. And there are several times when he goes back for various reasons. He backs up. He has this in his method note or his procedural note. But what's really different is the ends part, that he's not always taking the entire word. And that seems to me to open up something that is much more intuitive. He does it with some words. He doesn't do it with others. So he's giving word fragments at times. And there does not seem to me to be any systematic reason for that.
Pierre, what do you want to add to that?
He always gives himself some latitude. I mean,
every time
he uses a different complex method, he always finds a way of getting around it in some way, you know, of giving himself a little breathing room to make something happen, which may be also simply for him to have more fun doing it than just, you know, looking for the for
and
for
yet
the next
and
one.
Yet wouldn't he would I fell victim to this once. He was reading one of his Stein pieces here at Bard, actually, and I ran up afterwards, and there was one that was particularly beautiful. It just was musical, and I went up and I said, that particular one was very beautiful, and we all remember this. He gave me the quizzical look. One is more beautiful than the other. As if to say, this is a procedure and I really have nothing to do with this. But we're saying that's not quite true. We can discover either some motive or some semantic reason sometimes for what he does. Can you think of an example in this poem where he's starting to make a little bit of sense?
But can I just interject one thing?
Absolutely.
Which is that in the Virginia Woolf poems, he is absolutely 100% strict in the diastic method all the way through. And you can follow it. It's done with the text, the waves. He uses much longer strings instead of a name, Ezra Pound, where you're going to have not as rich of a possibility of your lexicon. He uses ridiculous in Piccadilly, for instance. So he's got all of those letters. And he's very strictly incorporating whole words, never varying from the method. So I have a question about that.
Please.
Which is, does he somehow trust Virginia Woolf's language more than he trusts Ezra Pound's? Is he more eager to interfere with Pound?
Well, I think I have an answer to that, but I'm the host, so I'll ask Pierre and Charles to comment on that. Where's the Pound here?
Paradiso.
Gets repeated a lot.
That word should come up. I did not verify, check it if that actually came up in his method completely, but to have three times the word paradiso come up is astonishing. You know, if that is chance, then it's like...
Do you know what else is astonishing? At the very end of the poem, he reaches the point where this poem ends with the E, et. So the 10th section must begin with the Z. Mm-hmm. Now, Canto 120 has no Z in it. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, his 10th piece is silence. And that's how Ezra Pound ended his life, with these much reduced fragments up to 117, 118. Then he gets to 120 and Pound. So in a way, he's replicating the silence of the end of Pound. And he noted in a prefatory comment, this is in Penn Sound, he says, well, that's perfect because my system led me to a kind of cognate idea. The system led me to say something about Pound that I really wanted to say, which is that it ends in silence. That sounds pretty non-accidental to me. Charles, what are your thoughts?
No, I think it's a result of the text selection. The text selection process is very complex in this work, and it's hard to follow. The punctuation also sets off line breaks. But I think he's following the text selection process systematically, and I don't think that he's making variations in it, given the process that he creates, which is hard to follow at times. But every time I've wondered why he's done one thing or another, I can sort of figure it out as best I can based on the original procedure. I think the procedure he picked in this is extremely complex, and it does create a very variegated relationship to the cantos. But there's much to be said about the relation of what he called, after all, he didn't like the term chance. He preferred to call it quasi-intentional, because there's an enormous amount of intention. I think that the blank page, which is the final page of this work, the 120th, is incredible.
It's incredible.
But I think it's incredible partly because it is serendipitous, or it's a result of the text selection process. The text selection process does produce no results. That blank, that silence, if you want, does speak to Pound's supposed, although not actual, silence. It also speaks to the blank space that he's creating for the cantos. I think the whole work is a kind of expurgating of the demonic aspects of the cantos, and I think that certainly is intentional.
I really want to come back to that, but I have to ask Joan a question about the 120th. What's the difference between his serendipitously, accidentally, quasi-chancily arriving at the 120th, where he now needs a Z and can't find one, and therefore is silent, replicating the end of Pound?
Blank.
What's the difference?
It's not silent.
Sorry, blank. Well, he performs it for Ernesto silently. There is a silent performance. What's the difference between his coming upon that and then discovering the idea, the theme, and having someone else intentionally going silent at the end of a piece in order to... What's better about his having come upon it through his process?
Well, I think what's better is that he's been in collaboration with chance, and we know that, and that gives us a sense of the marvels of contingency and the fact that we are not and don't have to be the sole composers of good things in the world. I mean, that's what I would say. I do feel, though, that these last cantos are anything but silent, that they're full right. of extremely interesting developments, and that...
Such as apology?
Well, you know, I went...
Regret?
Since I've been reading this, I wondered if we could call these the recantos. Is he on some level recanting? And I think that that's it's there
he being
at least
Jackson McClough,
part of
he
the time.
Being
no, Jackson McClough. Ezra Pound
masquerading as Ezra Pound.
No, let's stay
no
with Pound
Ezra
for a
Pound.
Second. Yeah,
Ezra
ahead.
Pound. And to what extent is Jackson allowing that to enter? What he's doing.
You're saying in the cantos itself, or just this section of the cantos that Pound is recanting?
This section of the cantos.
The late ones.
Yeah.
Because,
of course,
he has a line in there that says, to confess wrong without losing rightness.
Yeah.
So it's not complete, but he also, this is the famous section of cantos where he says, you know, it coheres all right, even if my notes do not cohere, very famous line. Many errors, a little rightness. Mm-hmm. To excuse his hell, so now his, and my paradiso.
Oh.
And as to why they go wrong, thinking of rightness, and as to who will copy this palimpsest, this is rendered, by the way, by Jackson. That whole thing is rendered by Jackson as over, excuse, hell becomes double L, and paradiso. It's almost as if Jackson has, through his process, become the person in the who will copy my palimpsest. All I could think of was Jackson McClough coming on along years later with his anarcho-pacifisms, a whole lot less hatred than Pound, and essentially, you're looking at me, Charles, softening and exaggerating the apology.
I would say it's McClough's procedure that produces that
yes,
voice, not McClough, and I would be not want to attribute it. As to the book itself, of course, it treats the entire cantos, not just this section. As to those comments about Pound, the reason that it doesn't cohere is because the Axis powers, not the Albany to
Brooklyn Albany Axis.
Axis, but the Axis
like
powers
phrase,
did not win, and the paradise would be the victory of fascism. So if it doesn't cohere, it's because the fascist project failed. It's the opposite of an apology
It's not cohering. It is partly the poem, and of course, partly the ideas.
Right. But the poem itself fails because fascism
by the
fails. That's the most strident position. And I'd say, why not take the most strident position about it? It's sort of the one that he took. There's no indication that he ever thought anything different than what I'm saying. And in order to understand the greatness of the poem, it's important to understand the nature of the fragmentation.
Et France is l'empire. Forces, a nuisance, was Napoleon all 22nd. Aryization. Der ed talleyrand political. E orage id up der night al and e isentines prologo ulta. Perform per. E juniper was and e landy Ozart overhanging beat pace to
In Pound, he takes the line, then bronze bearing dreary arms, and he gets, because you can hear it more, the Ezra string is very apparent in almost every word, en ons earing ori arms. So the N's earring is the third, Ori doesn't count, and arms is the A. So that's the Ezra. And the Pound comes from pallor upon slaughtered, slain, poured ointment. That's the Pound. And the McClough, again, in the very beginning of the piece, is pallor pond, lautered, ored, ent. So the lautered is a fantastic L-A cap U, which is a kind of laughter, slaughtered, seems to be a kind of comment. Once you start to read it as a comment, it all of a sudden gives you this incredible interpretive quality to it or allegorical, the politics of the poetic form which he chose, he after all chose this form to work on this particular text, is incredibly rich. And you can interpret what exactly the procedure allows, what the accident
allows.
But it
doesn't require you where you come out as an interpreter.
That's right. The commentary that's done through a structure, perhaps you could call it a structure of democratic social space. Perhaps you could call it a structure of a sort of...
Absolutely. Let's go even further than that. I mean, when Pound, at the end of his life, according to a number of people, not everybody agrees with this generalization, but Pound, at the very end, came to hate or regret and hate the violent language that he had used to express the certitude of his convictions. Here comes Jackson McCloe, who's in his early years particularly was very, very clear about his politics, anarchism and pacifism. And I think to some degree he remained an anarcho-pacifist all his life. So what an interesting moment. This is why the Ninth is so interesting to me. He comes to Pound at the mm-hmm. point where Pound is somewhat regretting the violence of his language. Or as he said to Don Hall in 1960 when he was interviewed in 1960 in Italy, this is a quote from Pound, "I must find a verbal formula to combat the rise of brutality." And in a way, this is a belated invitation to Jackson McCloe, who comes and finds, in my opinion, just the formula, a kind of quasi-ego-reducing chance operation that becomes a verbal formula to combat the brutality of the poem.
That McCloe's is a liberatory structure.
Exactly.
And of course, I think of this as being McCloe's masterpiece in a certain way, this particular poem, both because of the selection and also what it allows. The key thing is that the interpretations that we're making are not intended at every level, the selection process, so that meaning, the concept of what meaning is radically transformed. That's the opposite of Pound's logocentric, neo-fascist conceptions of meaning. The problem with the Cantos, understood as a neo-fascist text, is that he tries to take all of the world's civilizations, East and West, and interpret what is great about them and to have an intentional montage. McCloe rips that apart and opens up the textual paradise that also is what is great about the Cantos. The greatness of this poem is also the greatness of the Cantos. The Cantos is not any less great because of these
horrible things
about it, but it shows you what the textual paradise within the Cantos is.
Joan, Pierre, comments on this topic. I know you both want to say something. Pierre first.
Well, it now looks as if the three paradisos, as I are actually come out of the name Pound, the first P mm-hmm. in the final lecture. So Pound gives paradiso.
Perfect. Subject rhyme through the process. Beautiful. Joan, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think about the poetics of the McCloe poem. However he chose to compose it, it has an ethical presence in the way it's composed. And the fact that this is such a fine sieve means that going along from the early cantos, certainly the Pisan cantos, etc., he is filtering out and, in a sense, he is successfully having a kind of, he's... Actually, you're not going to like this. No one's going to like this. But he's censoring Pound's.
Well, I think he's exercising is what I would say.
Well, I think he's censoring, and then the question becomes, is this an exorcism?
And how do you spell that censoring? It's S-E-N-S, too. He's giving sense of a different kind and sensibility and sentience.
Pound was already a long way toward anti-censor nonsense at this point.
But the method... that mean that all the poets that he treats with a given method of that order be censored in that sense?
Well, I don't think so, because of the contrast that I'm finding so interesting with the Virginia Woolf poems.
Yeah. Well,
but what this means is, by the time you get to the final poems, where I think I agree with Al, if I understand what you're saying, that there are moments that are very important where Pound is saying things like, that love be the cause of hate, something is twisted, And then the reference to the fragments and the ruin, shoring against the ruin. But he's claiming the ruin, I think, for himself in this. He says, actually, at the very end, let those I love try to forgive what I have made, to be men, not destroyers. I mean, these are, I think, these are very important. Now, I'm not saying that McClough should have changed his method in the last two books, for the very end. But to me, there's a question here. Al and I were looking at one of the siftings in the very beginning, and it's, I think, very instructive to read what Pound is actually saying, and then what comes across in McClough. There's something, let's say, unintentionally subversive in what McClough ends up with, unintentionally because, of course, it's chance that's being subversive in this case. But
how can you read that? A procedure that allows for that fundamental agonism? I think the agonism is profound between Pound and McClough. What you're saying about a recantation, or it's a re-singing, it's also a palinode, as if structurally in the voice of Pound. That is to say, an apology or a recantation. And it's very interesting as a great recantatory poem. It also presents a much more radical version of the Bloomian influence than Harold Bloom has, because here is a strong poet.
You mean the anxiety of influence?
The anxiety of influence.
Jackson to Ezra?
Right, because there would be a classic
pair.
We've got
to swerve around Ezra. Everybody has to swerve around Ezra.
Right. Or swerve
but, you know,
around.
If we want to be, if we want to be Bloomian,
swerve is good. But it's
if we
want to
be Bloomian,
which
is finally Freudian, right? Ultimately, that's
right.
A Freudian
and
idea.
This then becomes
Sounds like this. It sounds like this. Pound, fragments. It's all that a ruin. It didn't work. Fragments. Here are my last poems. Mm-hmm. Fragments. Jackson, you want fragments?
Let's
do fragments. So you want to hear the real Pound?
Yeah.
Listen to me.
It's a pataphysical revisioning rather than a Freudian one or a Lucretian one. It's a swerve. And I think this is it's a more interesting model to me than the psychoanalytic one in Bloom. The other thing is the relation to Cage, more of a kind of older brother.
Right.
Cage, of course, pioneered some of the techniques that Jackson later used in his quasi-intentional work. And, of course, Joan can speak about this in a second. But I think Cage himself felt that this was the more interesting treatment of Pound.
I'm going to set Joan up for a comment on Cage if she wants to. I keep hearing Cage saying, as he did in an interview in the 70s, and maybe many times, I went around the country trying to make language, I think he said English, actually, English less understandable, because if we could make it less understandable, we will stop hurting other people, and we will begin to be able to live, do our living, he said, if we could make language less understandable. And it seems to me that that would be a nice thing to say to Ezra Pound at the end of his life.
But Cage did do a version of the cantos. He did a diastic reading
Indeed.
Through that's much, much
reading
less
down.
Disruptive. And I think that it's much, to me, it's not as powerful a work as this one of McClough. As I understand it, Cage himself said that to McClough. And
he did,
so,
yeah.
And also, of course, one of the factoid is that McClough was in touch with Cage, and was in touch with Pound. There's a Freudian slip of some kind. Was in touch with Pound.
He was indeed.
He broke off the relationship with Pound.
Right. Well,
he had letters sort of moving and so on,
in different
so it's
directions.
Not just in the abstract.
I invite Joan to comment on any of this. Cage, the relationship with Pound and McClough, any of that.
Cage did, in fact, feel that that Pound's Words and Ends for Ez were much more interesting than his own.
Than McClough's Words and Ends.
I'm sorry, that, yes, McClough's.
Right,
oh, my God.
Right. Lots
we,
of slips going on
We clearly have co-authoring going on here.
Right.
And what Cage said was that was, he felt it was because McClough admired Pound more than he, Cage, did.
Interesting.
That he felt Cage.
So more agonistic
that,
in that
yes.
Way, yeah.
One of the things that was, to me, so always interesting about the way Cage worked was he thought out his procedures very carefully in advance, not so that he would know what was going to happen in the parts of the structure that would allow chance operations to choose the points, as he would put in a text, that would come into the composition. But because he knew that the way you choose your procedure has a lot to do with extremely important formal elements, ultimately, and that he chose actually to let more of Pound in, I think ultimately was unpleasant for him because he didn't like the Pound that he was letting in his composition. I think the reason to continue reading Pound and to continue the agonistic relationship we all have to have with Pound when we read Pound is because it's such a presentation of the complexities and the horrifying things that can happen to a mind that is going in directions that are passionate without empathy, without contact with others. Pound became a kind of island unto himself.
Ye mind ere ears state Paris, nor fruit thing said Esser Ozart, friends to each peace world, und husk finished to tides e rzo hirten heaven paradiso e over xfus il and paradiso. E o Zagros, e arch great paradiso, soa noir. A sunling de et.
Beyond any of the agonism and the relation to power and so on, what Baclow's poem is a great pleasure. It's an incredible performance and performative pleasure of language, no matter what. And as you said, it's multilingual. You know, it turns around so that the sounds change with Italian and French thrown in. And, of course, you know, if you listen to it...
It gets a little carried away with the Italian.
Absolutely.
I never think of Jackson McCloy as someone who gets carried away with the performance, but there he did, didn't he?
Jackson hamming it up, which is a very strange idea, right? But yes, no, I mean, it made me laugh. And it is that incredible pleasure that I've always had in Jackson's language.
Do you think, any of us, do you think that the pleasure that one gets from, this is approaching music, the pleasure that one gets from it is enough to persuade skeptics and doubters who would look at this and say, I don't know what it means. How could you make me like this? Not that we have to persuade or convince, but invite them into the pleasure. Is this a way into this poem? This is a kind of a stupid question, but it looks like you know how to answer it.
The performance?
Yeah, or just reminding people that there's a sound here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a somewhat Baroque conversation that we've had. It should be a Rococo conversation to be more McCloy-like, not around the center, but there's such a heavy center here that we're
because
overly focused on it, and
right.
I think I certainly
right. That's why I want to talk
Pierre
about music.
I think McCloy did think of his work as primarily performance, and the play that it has on the ear. And I think it's crucial to hear the sound files on Penn Sound,
absolutely,
as an entry into his work. I think this is also something he shares with Cage, that this is sound work that frees the language from a kind of heavy logos, that everything means something and allows for a more dispersed, ambient meaning. And this ambient meaning is something you hear all the time. Also, it's just fantastic.
Can you define ambient meaning?
A nuisance was Napoleon, brings to mind to me as a close reader the relationship between Stein. Oh, yeah. Now, we all, you thought
we
that
know
about
the,
my saying. Yeah.
We know
a
the poem, the
portrait
Picasso,
of Picasso
portrait.
If I told
who
him,
came first, Napoleon
right.
the first.
So now that, of course, is an artifact of the process. It's an artifact of the fantastic nouns that are planted in the original
text. That Stein came out
text.
Was a complete accident.
But the Napoleon is not an accident, because Napoleon speaks to what we're saying. And also, a nuisance was Napoleon is also a very funny sort of send-up. So how do you get this kind of intentional humor and reference to Stein? After all, McClough also did a diastic reading of Stein in a work like that. Well, there's something uncanny about it. This uncanniness is fundamentally pleasurable. Once you think about it more, we can't in this short time get into how it is possible to have this kind of uncanny meaning. But that is the way in which intentionality and meaning works in a system of language, in a society, and in an intertextual poem that refers to a whole range of other poetic works.
Joan Retallack, your thoughts on this?
Well, I love what Charles has just said and completely agree with it, that the collaboration with chance brings about what we then see as coincidence, and that that somehow is more savory than it would be if we knew it had been intentionally composed.
I agree.
I think that's one of the things that happens. It's so piquant.
To get back to Al's first question, how can we get somebody to read this and say, well, I think the important thing is, one, it has to be heard first, and then it has to be read aloud. That is, you take it, you get somebody, hey, read this. Play with that. Get your mouth around it. That's in a very physical sense where the poem begins to do its work, is in the soma, in the body, rather than in the logos, you know. Which
so your
then
experience
you can take
of this is somatic, would you say?
Very much so.
Joan?
Well, I of course it's somatic. I mean, what isn't on every
point.
Level? And language is grandly, resonantly somatic. I would rather draw people into interest in this poem in relation, intertextually, with Pan's cantos. For me, this is not a favorite text of McClough's. And you probably can guess that from some of the earlier things that I was saying. However, it, for me, poses extremely interesting questions of the use that we make of extremely complex and partly disturbing texts that pose enormous moral, ethical, socio-political questions for us. And with that in mind, I feel reading this alongside the cantos, selected cantos throughout, is bound to yield things that will be as interesting as the conversation we're having.
But
if
we're first going to this question, the problem of people having to read poetry of either of those two orders today, to start them off by putting both together may be very problematic. So my sense would always be to try to get the playfulness first in, get people into, say, into that somatic pleasure. And, you know, I think here there is logos there, because everything we have talked about, the relation to Pound, the complexities of that are there. But to begin with, the text has to be experienced in that somatic pleasure of language, of making language in the mouth.
This is, notwithstanding the fact that this is an extra long special, the only poem talk that's longer than 30 minutes, this is a special one. We could go on for another 2 hours. What I'd like to do is invite each of us to say one last thing that maybe hasn't been covered, or a piece of the poem that you wanted to add briefly. Charles, you have one last thought on this?
Yes, for me, this is interesting as a way to understand what reading can be, and it is interesting to actually try to take the poem and read it against the original source, to see what happens, because it gives you a closer and I think a more complex reading of the original source. But what I mostly want to say is that for me this is a foundational work of Midrashic antinomianism, which, as you know, is my field, Ben studies. And I feel that this work really exemplifies the possibilities for both the field of Ben studies in the academic sciences and also for Midrashic antinomianism.
You know, everybody knows, of course, that Charles is referring to Midrashic antinomianism 101, which he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Pierre, a last thought?
Perform.
Juniper.
That is a great I love the way he pronounces juniper in the poem. Thank you, Pierre. Joan?
Well, since Charles is covering the Midrashic front, I would say that this poem is a wonderful, both agonistic and playful conversation with Pound's original text.
And I just wanted to add, thank you, Joan, I just wanted to add a translation from one or the other that hasn't been mentioned. Pounds, in Canto 115, Pounds, when one's friends hate each other, how can there be peace in the world, becomes, in Jackson's diastic, friends to each peace world? And to me, I think Jackson is very wise about that problem. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of what we call gathering paradise, a chance for us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail, to commend someone or something going on in the poetry world, which is an elaborate Dickinsonian way of saying, what do you recommend? Pierre, Joris, you're first. What do you recommend?
Well, right now I can only think of Akila Oliver. I looked at her work last night as we all gathered to think of her, and I think it would be important to read Akila's work at this point.
And indeed, there's a Penn Sound page full of recordings as well. So, in memoriam, Charles Bernstein.
Because we're here on Penn Sound, I recommend just a new Penn Sound resource, which is an extraordinary one, the North of Invention videos from the two-day festival we had at Penn with 10 Canadian poets reading and talking. An extraordinary example of community in action.
And just go to Penn Sound and type North of Invention in the search box and you'll find it. Joan Retallick, Gather Some Paradise.
I'd like to recommend two books, that one very recently out, Caroline Bergvall's Bergvall's Metal English, which is a tour de force, as is everything she does. And actually, a good deal of that can be read against Chaucer in a lovely way. And Julie Carr's 100 Notes on Violence, which is a beautifully minimalist form that it does more than one would imagine simply by looking at the graphics on the page.
And my gathering paradise entails simply recommending that people come to Bard College, which is just a couple of hours north of New York, and stand in front of the Fisher Center for the Arts, Frank Gehry Building, and watch the snow melt off the strangest roof that's ever been constructed.
But don't stand too close.
Oh, Joan, that was perfect. Well, that's all the friends to each piece world we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Charles Bernstein, Pierre Joris. This is your time to applaud, live audience. Charles Bernstein, Pierre Joris, Joan Retallick, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lamar, who came all the way from Philly for this, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin, and again to Joan Retallick and her Bard College colleagues, whoever they were, to help us get here and for hosting us today. Joan, thank you. Next time on Poem Talk, Johanna Drucker, Julia Block, and Jessica Lowenthal talk with me about Rosemarie Waldrop's take on the short American memory of the Declaration of Independence. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.